and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for John Kiriakou, and joined in studio by Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, the White House announced today that the second summit between Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un will take place in late February at a yet-to-be-determined location. This dramatic announcement comes after North Korean lead negotiator Kim Yong-chol visited Washington to meet with Trump and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. Next, a new story published by BuzzFeed is being called a bombshell that will lead to Donald Trump either resigning or being impeached. The story, however, is based on anonymous sources. It asserts that Donald Trump directed his then-personal lawyer, Michael Cohen, to lie to Congress about the nature and timing of negotiations between the Trump Organization and individuals in Moscow who are trying to broker a deal to set up a Trump Tower in that city. We'll take a look at the story and its authors. Then, four activists with the humanitarian organization No More Deaths are on trial in Tucson, Arizona, facing charges from an arrest in 2017 related to their efforts to place life-saving supplies like water in a stretch of desert near the U.S.-Mexico border to prevent migrants from dying of thirst and starvation. The outcome of the case will have wide-reaching implications for humanitarians and immigrant rights activists. And then, as Jeremy Corbyn comes closer and closer to becoming the Prime Minister of the UK, attacks against him are ramping up. One line of attack has been the allegation that Corbyn, a longtime supporter of Palestinian rights and opponent of intervention in the Middle East, is anti-Semitic. Now, a new report shows that bot accounts on social media are being used to provide false evidence for these claims. And finally, we'll take a look at the worst, most misleading, funniest, and just plain wrong headlines of the past week. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to the meeting at the White House between Donald Trump and North Korean leadership. The White House announced today that the second summit between Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un will take place in late February at a yet-to-be-determined location. This dramatic announcement comes after North Korean lead negotiator Kim Yong-chol visited Washington to meet with Trump and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. We're joined from Seattle by Professor Simone Chun. Professor Chun is a fellow at the Korea Policy Institute and a member of the Korean Peace Network. Professor Chun, welcome back.
Nice to be back.
Simone Chun, this is, again, I would have to say, for those people who have been following the events, not just in the last year or two, but for, let's say, decades, and certainly for Korean people in the North, in the South, Koreans living overseas, this is an announcement that can't but be greeted with enthusiasm.
Indeed, I just posted a reply to a Twitter, and I am so happy as a Korean-American, North Korean, and also for as a peace activist. And the latest breaking news, the Twitter says that a second summit, which will take place near the end of February. And, you know, in spite of this announcement, there has been a sort of major deadlock for many months. And this is clearly one of the most important news and very hopeful news. And it really shows that, most importantly, the Korea-led peace process is indeed a key to the successful negotiation between United States and North Korea. And also there are the news that we don't hear much about is all the grassroots organization and peace activists and Korean-American communities. And also, you know, overwhelming majority of Koreans who have supported the peace process. So clearly this is amazing news, and I am so happy to hear the announcement for the second summit.
I'm looking at the CNBC story, which was published just minutes after the announcement from the White House. And I have to say, the language is unlike your language of enthusiasm, or the language and the sentiment and the feelings of Korean people and other people who believe and want peace. The tone of this article is so dour. It's so filled with negativity. What accounts for the negative response from the media to the prospects for an end to a war? I mean, every war, as we say over and over again, has a beginning, and all wars have an end except this war. Why not end the Korean War, and why wouldn't this be good news for everybody?
we have discussed many times in the past that there is a huge establishment that actually benefits from having this perpetual war on the Korean Peninsula. There is huge military industrial complex and the Pentagon, and also, you know, the even the countries around, surrounding the Korean Peninsula that are still in a very serious arms race. So we have to address the, you know, those concerns. And also, if you look at the American media, you know, even from the since the Singapore summit, in spite of this major breakthrough between United States and North Korea with the regard to the diplomacy towards the denuclearization process, you know, the media has, American corporate media has never been enthusiastic or recognizing any progress that has been made. So it is no surprise. But nevertheless, I think this is, as you know, we have to remember, this is the major breakthrough. What it means will be that a declaration, possibly this year we're going to have a declaration to end the 1950 and 53 Korean War, also possibly resuming some of those humanitarian aid to North Korea and a permanent North and South Korea, you know, open dialogue channel, creating those dialogue channel. And so for these reasons, I think it's really important that we really, you know, look at the corporate media, that corporate media should wake up and, you know, give really accurate coverage of the progress that is being made.
Yeah, again, looking at just the third paragraph of this CNBC story, quote, while Trump has worked to thaw relations with Kim over the last year, including through an unprecedented face-to-face meeting in Singapore, North Korea is reportedly still working on new missile development projects. Well, North Korea never said at the Singapore summit, oh, by the way, as soon as we go home, we're going to completely disarm. In fact, the Singapore summit established 4 points, the first of which, and this was 2 points before the issue of denuclearization, was that both countries should establish normal, that is, friendly relations. And the second point was to establish a peace instrument or a peace regime on the Korean Peninsula. Now, the people in North Korea and South Korea and their leaderships in both sides of the Koreas, they're doing just that. They're creating an instrument for peace and a peace regime step by step on the Korean Peninsula. It seems to me, Professor Simone Chun, that the real issue and the issue that's being obscured by American media coverage is point number one of the Singapore summit, the agreement that Trump and Kim Jong-un signed together, which was for Washington to end its policy of hostility towards North Korea. If it were to do that, I believe that North Korea, which has already taken significant unilateral steps, concessions really, North Korea would completely reciprocate. Go ahead.
Yeah, indeed. I think that the first very feasible outcome that we're going to have is North Korea dismantling facilities that allow North Korea to expand its existing stock of fissile material and nuclear weapons in the future, like such as Yongbyon and as other testing sites. And one other, in relate to that, and as you mentioned, as you pointed out very well, that, you know, in order to, for the complete denuclearization, the most important precondition is to a normalization between United States and North Korea. And that is the ending U.S. hostility, right? And that means that signing an end of war a declaration and eventually signing a peace treaty. Now, I would like to point out one more important point. That is, as you know, it is not North Korea that started this nuclear crisis on the Korean Peninsula. It is the United States who introduced, who had kept actually almost 950 nuclear warheads in South Korea until 1991. And even now, we have, U.S. nuclear umbrella, South Korea is U.S. under U.S. nuclear umbrella, which has the capability to strike anytime North Korea from nearby submarines or bombers. And moreover, as you remember yesterday, Trump called for enhanced the missile defense system, which means that, you know, some analysts point out that maybe, you know, North United can, you know, like to decapitation strike against North Korea. So the point that I'm making is that U.S. corporate media's focus only on North Korea, what North Korea has, North Korea has not done, while not, you know, pointing out to threat the United States has posed and continue to pose on the Korean Peninsula. And still, I think that it is a very, very important step that we have to recognize. And the first step is, indeed, as you pointed out, normalization between the United States and North Korea.
I'm so glad you made that point, Professor Simone Chun. I mean, the U.S. has B-1 bombers, B-2 bombers, B-52 bombers. It has land-based nuclear missiles. It has nuclear missiles on Trident submarines. All three legs of the trilogy, the three points of America's nuclear strategic force, they're all around and pointing at North Korea, even if they're no longer on South Korean land as they were, as you pointed out, starting in 1958. When we're talking about denuclearization, why should the North Koreans not insist that they too become free from the nuclear menace posed by the United States? Again, this is something that Americans need to realize, and it's not coming through the corporate-owned media. Because, of course, North Korea, which Donald Trump a year and a half ago threatened to annihilate, was in fact annihilated in 1950 to 53. So I think that's a central point here. 1 minute left.
I'd also point out that the denuclearization and any peace process in the Korean Peninsula is good for American taxpayers. As you know, the 67% of all federal discretionary spending goes to military. And the reducing threat with using creating permanent peace on the Korean Peninsula saves American taxpayers huge money. And finally, well, I would like to point out that, you know, the importance of ending the Korean War, you can really eliminate another major costly war on the Korean Peninsula. And also you can, you know, by having normalization between United States and North Korea, we can take a step toward a nuclear-free Northeast Asia. And finally, I think that we can also address the real humanitarian concerns, invest our resources on human security rather than perpetual war. So for these reasons, I think we should support the current peace process. We should end the Korean War. We should sign a peace treaty, and we should support all those peace activists, and also including critical media, amazing media such as you, who has done an amazing job to even bring about these progress.
Wise words from Professor Simone Chun. She's a fellow at the Korea Policy Institute and a member of the Korean Peace Network. Professor Chun, how can people learn more about Korea? What website should they go to learn more?
There are many awesome websites. There are Women Cross DMZ. There's also Zoom in Korea, who bring critical news about Korea. And also you can follow also my Twitter and Korea Peace Network, Facebook. And there are so many amazing websites that you can visit, and I'm happy to provide more information.
And to follow you on Twitter, it's at Simone Chun, that's C-H-U-N. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. A new story published by BuzzFeed is being called a bombshell that will lead to Donald Trump either resigning or being impeached. The story, though, is based on anonymous sources. It asserts that Donald Trump directed his then personal lawyer, Michael Cohen, to lie to Congress about the nature and timing of negotiations between the Trump Organization and individuals in Moscow who were trying to broker a deal to set up a Trump Tower in Moscow. We'll take a look at the story and its authors. We're joined from New York by Daniel Lazar. Daniel is a journalist and the author of three books, The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. Daniel Lazar, welcome back. Daniel Lazar, let's look at this story. It's authored by Jason Leopold, BuzzFeed news reporter, who I have to say does not have a glorious history in terms of having a factually correct set of stories. In fact, many of them have been disproved. It's also authored by Anthony Cormier. The title of the article is President Trump Directed His Attorney, Michael Cohen, to Lie to Congress About the Moscow Tower Project. We already know, Daniel Lazar, that Michael Cohen pled guilty to one count back in November to having lied to Congress about the Trump Organization's negotiations with this individual, Felix Sater, about the possibility of setting up Trump Tower in Moscow. Earlier, Michael Cohen had told Congress that those negotiations ended in January 2016. He then admitted, and this is what he pled guilty to, that in fact, he had helped conduct negotiations that went on until June of 2016, around the time that Donald Trump won the Republican nomination. Now, anyway, what's your take on this story?
It's a long chain of sources. any of them are weak, the whole story fails. We have a reporter who, as you say, is factually challenged. We have two anonymous law enforcement officials. We don't know whether they're from the Trump team or someone else. And we have Cohen. And Cohen is extremely unreliable as well. And some of his other parts of his latest story don't make much sense. The idea of Trump traveling to Moscow, then suppose like Cohen says Trump told him to make it happen, the idea of Trump traveling to Moscow in the middle of the presidential campaign in order to do a real estate deal with Putin strikes me as extremely far-fetched. This real estate project, this Trump Tower, seems to have been a much ado about nothing. It was a 100-story tower, supposedly, with Ivanka Trump Fitness Center and a $50 million penthouse set aside for Putin himself. But there's zero indication of any reciprocity on the Russian side. The Putin's office refused to take Trump's calls. The only time they had their only contact with Trump was when Peskov, Putin's spokesman, delegated an underling to call Cohen to tell them that the president does not get involved in these kinds of deals. So the project went nowhere. It seems to have been a figment of Felix Sater's imagination. And now we have a report that Trump told Cohen to lie about it to Congress. So it's extremely, you know, there's a whole long chain here. It's not terribly plausible. There's a possibility it could be proved, of course. I'm not, you know, that's always that possibility.
Yeah, I hear you. Daniel, this article is authored by Jason Leopold. Again, we have anonymous sources. Again, the anti-Trump media, and we, just for our audience, we're not pro-Trump. We're opposed to Trump's policies, his reactionary policies. But from a point of view of fairness here, this is being treated as this new smoking gun that's going to end up with the resignation or impeachment of Donald Trump. And I just want to go through some of the facts here and about the authorship of the article. Jason Leopold, who's one of the two authors, he's the same reporter who in November 2017 published an article again in BuzzFeed about how Russia had sent $30,000 to finance the 2016 election. He wrote on August 3rd of last year, just as the U.S. presidential campaign was entering its final heated phase, the Russian Foreign Ministry sent nearly $30,000 to its embassy in Washington. The wire transfer, which came from a Kremlin-backed Russian bank, landed in one of the embassy's Citibank accounts and contained a remarkable memo line, quote, to finance election campaign of 2016, close quote. Jason Leopold, BuzzFeed, smoking gun, right? $30,000, except for this fact, that Russia was sponsoring its own election in 2016 for the Duma, its parliament, and all of the Russian embassies around the world, including the one in Washington, were setting up the apparatus and the infrastructure so that Russians who were entitled to vote could vote at the embassy or at the consulate. Again, a fake news story, and again, treated at that time as, you know, the final blow to Donald Trump. Authorship matters, credibility matters, and it's not the first time for Jason Leopold. Going back to as early as 2002, the man has had numerous false articles, fake news articles that have been, you know, ultimately proved to be false or have been taken down by the media organizations that put them up. Anyway, what about that?
There's a bombshell announcement every week, it seems. Paul Manafort meets with Julian Assange in the Peruvian embassy or the Ecuadorian embassy. I mean, every week brings a new bombshell. Every week, the press announced that Mueller has finally gotten Trump, that he's going to finally step down. Week after week after week, we are bludgeoned by these headlines and nothing ever happens. I mean, we can't help but be very skeptical as to where this is all leading.
You know, Pete Williams, who's a commentator now on MSNBC, certainly a media outlet that's not friendly to Donald Trump, was just discussing this story about this breaking news, this bombshell report. He's clearly not buying it. He said on air just today, and again, Pete Williams was the Assistant Secretary of Defense during the administration of George H.W. Bush. He's making this point. One, Mueller knew all about the discussions between Michael Cohen on behalf of Donald Trump with the individuals in Russia about the possibility of a business deal with Trump Tower in Moscow. Mueller knew about that. They've been interviewing Michael Cohen for a long time about it. So it's, quote, not news. And even if it's true, the issue is this. If Michael Cohen was told by Donald Trump, hey, don't bring up the fact that we continued the negotiations until June of 2016 instead of January 2016. If he said that to Michael Cohen, that would not be a criminal act. If he told Michael Cohen, go to Congress and lie to Congress about it, of course, that would be a criminal act. Go ahead.
That's clearly the case. I mean, we have a chain of unsubstantiated allegations that Trump actually said that. And we've been down this road before. They have never panned out. Trump would have been extremely stupid to have told Cohen anything like that. So, again, it's possible, but it seems we must be extremely skeptical at this point.
You know, I'm looking at some of the tweets from independent journalist Aaron Mate, and I really want to tell people, I think Aaron Mate's coverage has been objective, it's been independent, it's raised serious questions. He's also sort of going through the BuzzFeed article by Jason Leopold and Cormier. He just tweeted this, quote, he's quoting from the article, quote, two federal law enforcement officials involved in an investigation of the matter, close quote. What investigation? The Mueller one? If so, it's strange that the Mueller team now leaks after being tight-lipped for 2 years. If not the Mueller team, then who else? In other words, if BuzzFeed and Jason Leopold got this news based on anonymous sources, somebody leaked this. Is it the Mueller team? Why would the Mueller team be leaking this? Because they've already been talking to Michael Cohen. They know everything that Michael Cohen has to say. And if it's not Mueller's team, who actually might it be? And again, Donald Trump is tweeting right at this moment, Daniel Lazar, that all Michael Cohen is trying to do is to get a reduction in sentence. And of course, that's still on the table. What will Michael Cohen's sentence be for the crimes he's already pled guilty to, including mainly financial crimes in New York City?
I also want to emphasize that Mueller himself has a less than sterling record when it comes to veracity. I mean, Mueller is the guy who was part of George W. Bush's efforts to pin 9/11 on Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein. He went before Congress and delivered some of the most outrageously dishonest testimony that any Bush administration official delivered during the entire run-up to the 2003 invasion. Afterwards, he was part of the FBI cover-up of the Saudi role in the Twin Towers affair. So his own record is extremely spotty. So therefore, we have a whole string of unreliable sources here telling us, you know, behind this latest bombshell. So all I can say again is be very cautious, be very skeptical. It may be true, but I am extremely loath to believe it.
Yeah, and Daniel Lazar, as we wrap up, I also want to remind our audience that Robert Mueller, as the head of the FBI after 9/11, was the architect of a policy to arrest thousands, I mean literally thousands of people who were either Muslim or Arab American or South Asian or looked like they were Arab Americans or South Asian, and held them as material witnesses for weeks, sometimes for months. That's Robert Mueller. I don't think progressive and liberal people should be thinking that Robert Mueller, given his history, should be the one who's the, quote, guardian of our democracy. Anyway, we're completely out of time. That was Daniel Lazar. He's a journalist and author of three books, The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for John Kiriakou and joined in studio by Brian Becker. Four activists with the humanitarian organization No More Deaths are on trial in Tucson, Arizona, facing charges from an arrest in 2017 related to their efforts to place life-saving supplies like water in a stretch of desert near the U.S.-Mexico border to prevent migrants from dying of thirst and starvation. The outcome of the case will have wide-reaching implications for humanitarians and immigrant rights activists everywhere in the country. We're joined from Phoenix by Justine Schnitzler, a volunteer and staff member with No More Deaths. Welcome, Justine.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So tell us, what are the basics of this case? I mean, what are the activists with your organization, No More Deaths, being charged with? What is the prosecution saying? And what's the response by activists?
So this is a federal misdemeanor trial. There are three charges that our activists are facing. The first is driving on a wildlife refuge without a permit. The second is entering a wildlife refuge without a permit. And the third is abandonment of property, which in this case means humanitarian aid supplies like the water you mentioned. And in terms of response from activists, we are fortunate to have had, you know, an outpouring of support, but it's all grounded in the idea that, you know, everyone is a little bit worried about the criminalization of humanitarian aid and what that would mean for this kind of work in the desert. So it's definitely an important trial and an important case.
Yeah, absolutely. And so what's the defense?
We believe that humanitarian aid should never be a crime. It's pretty simple. Our group's mission is to prevent death and suffering in the U.S. border or along the U.S. border and in the borderlands. And the Cabeza Prieta National Wildlife Refuge, which is the area in question, is one of the deadliest migration corridors in the Southwest. And we know that because when we began to have a humanitarian presence on the refuge, we began to recover more human remains that had been previously documented. So we know that people are dying and they're in need of water. Our services are needed.
Yeah, it's just mind-numbing that there would be a prosecution, right? That the federal government would invest resources, the time, the energy to prosecute activists, humanitarian activists, who are acting on deeply held religious beliefs, right?
And these prosecutions, I mean, there aren't just about aid workers, right? It's about people who are choosing to help others. So the concern is if aid work like this is successfully prosecuted, what's the next step, right? Who else is in danger? And is this part of a larger escalation of government repression designed to deter people from helping others? So these are questions that are in the back of our mind this week.
Let's dig into that question, because I'm looking at an article that was published in The Intercept here. The headline is, "As Trial Starts for Border Humanitarian Volunteers, New Documents Reveal Federal Bureaucrats' Obsession with Stopping Activists." Tell us what you know about this. I mean, there seems to have truly been a concerted, extremely political effort to crack down on your organization in particular.
Yeah, I mean, we're not just facing federal misdemeanor charges, right? There's also a felony case that's ongoing against Dr. Scott Warren, another one of our volunteers. This is the same stretch of time in 2017. These charges were handed down. And, you know, previously, although No More Deaths has faced charges in the past, these have all been dismissed. And facing two federal charges in the span of a year, for efforts that we have been, you know, these types of activities we've been undertaking, we've been doing for years and years and years, very scary. And it's scary to think that there might be a broader apparatus at play in terms of, you know, concerted government effort to crack down on the work that we do. So this is part, we think, of a larger antagonism against immigrants, asylum seekers, non-citizens, right? It's not just about the aid work, it's also about the people that we try to help. And I think that's the broader target here.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, it's saving lives. I mean, that's the work that the government is trying to clamp down on here. I mean, saving people's lives. And it's not an exaggeration at all. Let's talk a little bit more about the broader, you know, humanitarian crisis that exists along the border. I mean, you were mentioning the huge number of deaths that occurred along the border. Get a little bit more into that. I mean, what are, you know, the hardships that migrants face making this extremely perilous, treacherous journey?
Right. Well, in the case of, I can speak to Cabeza Prieta area in specifics as one of the harshest environments in North America. Summertime temperatures, you're looking at 120 degrees, you know, air temp, and then upwards of 180 degrees surface temperature, which is, I mean, it's astounding to think about, really. No natural water sources exist on the refuge. And if you're crossing, you're facing dozens and dozens and dozens of miles without that water source. It's virtually impossible for a human being to cross that without assistance, right? So already you're up against those, you know, environmental factors. And then in terms of this larger crisis of death and disappearance, I think it relates to, Donald Trump is in his immigration address a few weeks ago discussed a humanitarian crisis, right? But he switched it and framed it in terms of a humanitarian crisis that's the fault of, I suppose, folks who are choosing to undertake this journey. But we know that the real crisis on the border is death and disappearance partly at the hands of government policies, right? So as the government increases militarization, we're going to continue to see this tragedy. And it's horrifying. It really is. It's devastating to see as an aid worker, but I also think just as a human being with a heart.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the militarization of the border, in addition to sort of the increasing militancy of a CBP, of the Border Patrol agents itself. I mean, we saw Donald Trump, pretty recently send the actual U.S. armed forces to the border, clearly a political send, but also something that bodes very, it's extremely dangerous in terms of the overall direction of things. Talk a little bit about the effect of that deployment. I mean, I know that it's not exactly where you are now, but I'm sure that it has sort of ripple effects all across the border region.
I think knowing that that's what's going on, even if it's not directly something that we're encountering in terms of like agents in the field, or it's scary. I can tell you that one of our organization like working groups is out of Nogales, which is a town that's both in Sonora and on the U.S. side in Arizona. And, you know, Nogales is a sleepy port of entry. People cross it daily to work, to see family, to see friends. And we received, an image and a video from someone who had taken footage down at that port of entry and showed that there was, full-on riot gear. Folks were wearing riot gear as they fully deployed troops at the border. And it was so striking, right, to see this kind of movement of troops in an area where that's just not the reality on the ground, right? This is not, if you live in the borderlands, you are familiar with, the border is an everyday reality of life, which is often scary, but it's not really looked like this, right? So it was absolutely a stark contrast and a stark change to what we had seen previously.
In terms of the U.S. government's policies towards immigrant rights in general, and particularly along the border, I mean, there's a lot of change, but there's also a lot of continuity in terms of the Trump administration, because the Obama administration deported enormous numbers of people. I mean, far more than his predecessors. But, with Donald Trump now, it's sort of more explicitly animated by like racial hostility. The rhetoric has been amped up. So I just wanted to get your thoughts on, what's changed, what's stayed the same in terms of the situation, the humanitarian situation along the border.
Right. So in 1994, that's when prevention through deterrence became a policy of the U.S. border and the U.S. government, which essentially closed off urban points of entry and pushed people to crossing into deadlier and deadlier corridors, right? So more remote regions of the desert. And that's been in place since 1994. So that's when we really started to see a crisis of death and disappearance begin. And it's perpetual, right? That was true through the Clinton administration. That was true through Bush. It was true through Obama. And now it's true under Trump. So absolutely, Donald Trump's election, I think you'd see like an emboldening of rhetoric, like you mentioned, and perhaps that effect kind of trickling down through courts. That's to be seen. But yeah, in terms of the crisis of death and disappearance, we try to emphasize that this is something that's been ongoing and hasn't shown any signs of stopping anytime soon.
Yeah, we can definitely see with the case of the people from your organization, No More Deaths, who are being prosecuted. Certainly, it's trickled down to the courts and prosecutors. Do you think it's trickled down to the Border Patrol officers themselves?
Hard to say. You might have seen our organization released a video almost a year ago, actually, I think to the day, of a compilation of footage of Border Patrol agents messing with aid supplies. And that was the time frame of the video stretched from 2010 into 2017, right? So the Border Patrol's response to that video was, those are isolated incidents and those agents no longer work with us. But we had to ask the question, is this part of a larger culture within Border Patrol? And how long has this been in existence? It's hard to say. But I would say that it certainly didn't spring out of a vacuum in the last couple of years.
Yeah, we have just about 1 minute left. In our final question to you is just, if people want to get involved, if people want to learn more about these four humanitarian activists with your organization, No More Deaths, who are on trial, if people want to support them, where can they go to do that?
Well, I would certainly recommend that they check out The Intercept's reporting, because Ryan Devereaux has put out excellent work and several articles that will give folks pretty much all the information they need to learn about the cases. But in terms of supporting us, we take donations as an organization. We're volunteer run, and that money goes directly into helping people surviving this journey across the borderlands. So they're always welcome to look us up directly.
Okay, we're going to end it right there. We've been joined from Phoenix by Justine Schnitzler, a volunteer and staff member with No More Deaths. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. As Jeremy Corbyn comes closer and closer to becoming possibly the Prime Minister of the UK, attacks against him are ramping up. One line of attack has been the allegation that Corbyn, a longtime supporter of Palestinian rights and an opponent of imperial intervention in the Middle East, is in fact anti-Semitic. Now a new report shows that bot accounts on social media were being used and are being used to provide false evidence for these claims. We're joined from London by Asa Winstanley. He is an investigative journalist with the Electronic Intifada and a columnist at Middle East Monitor whose article, Fake Labor Accounts Fueling Anti-Semitism Crisis, that's the name of the story, he's the one who broke it. Asa, welcome.
Good to be with you.
Just break this down. What do you say in your story? What is your main charge?
Well, I've documented a network of fake accounts on Twitter over the course of the last three to four years now, which have posed as Labour Party members, activists, even Labour Party staffers. They've claimed all these things. And on the surface, when you first glance at their profiles, they appear to just be, you know, legitimate Labour Party activists, maybe retweeting Jeremy Corbyn or other Labour accounts. But when you look at their tweets and replies, you look at their replies to high-profile politicians on Twitter, they're actually spreading some extremely vicious anti-Semitism, violent incitement against Jews and others, some really openly nasty stuff. So the anti-Semitism is real, but the claim that they're Labour Party members or close to Jeremy Corbyn are entirely false because all these accounts have got stolen photos. Some of the accounts pose as Muslims. So they're trying to sort of, I suppose, play the role. Whoever's behind these troll accounts is trying to sort of play the role as a sort of Muslim extremist. And just to give you an example of how fabricated they are, one of the accounts steals, in their profile photo, is a stolen image of somebody called Muhammad Qutb, who was the younger brother of Saeed Qutb, who was a very influential ideologue in the Muslim Brotherhood. So there's kind of, you can kind of detect a sort of sick sense of humor there behind whoever's doing this. But as you said in the introduction, like one of the main smear attacks against Jeremy Corbyn is that he's either an anti-Semite or at least that he's tolerating anti-Semitism in the Labour Party. And what these accounts are trying to give the impression of is a party driven by anti-Semitism. In fact, these are fake accounts, as the evidence that I've sort of listed in my article shows.
There is this disturbing and long-running trend where if you come out for Palestinian rights, you're labeled as an anti-Semite, meaning against Jewish people. Of course, the government in Israel conflates Judaism and Jewish people with the state of Israel. I mean, it goes, you know, that's part of the narrative is that if you attack or criticize Israel, which represents and is conflated with the Jewish people and the religion of Judaism, then you are attacking Jews or Jewish people or the religion, the Jewish religion. Again, Jeremy Corbyn has been a longtime steadfast supporter of the Palestinian people's rights. Jeremy Corbyn is also a principled left socialist, anti-racist, and a firm opponent of anti-Semitism, of any kind of bigotry directed against Jewish people or against any people. I mean, that's the true record of Jeremy Corbyn. And yet you can't but notice that this campaign has been remarkably effective as dogging Corbyn with these rumors or the imagery that Corbyn is, if not an open anti-Semite, either secretly anti-Semitic or, as you said before, harboring anti-Semites. In other words, it's been pretty effective.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I mean, like you said, this strategy of accusing pro-Palestinian activists, Palestinians themselves, you know, anyone acting in solidarity or sympathy with Palestinians, of being anti-Semites, being motivated by anti-Semitism instead of concerns for human rights and equality and anti-racism, as we all are. It's an actual strategy by the Israeli government. You know, it's very self-consciously done, and it's incredibly dishonest, and it's actually damaging to any genuine effort to fight anti-Semitism, to fight genuine anti-Semitism. And as you've said, like, it has been effective in the Labour Party, I would say. It hasn't been maximally effective. So when you look at polls, for example, of the Labour Party membership, they're not convinced of this. They don't buy this at all. They don't buy this narrative. The idea that Labour Party is an anti-Semitic party is institutionally anti-Semitic, which is what's being claimed quite often now by people on the right in the UK. Actual grassroots Labour Party members don't believe that. Polling shows that time and time again. So it hasn't been maximally effective, but it has been effective in the sense that it's the most commonly occurring sort of attack vector against Jeremy Corbyn over the last 3 years, reoccurring. They've kind of thrown all the mud at the wall, basically. You know, they've called him an IRA terrorist sympathizer, you know, a Stasi spy at a certain point, you know, Putin apologist, Assad apologist, loony lefty, all these kind of different things. And most of it actually doesn't stick, you know, it doesn't. And actually, there's an effect whereby the more they make those kind of attacks, Corbyn almost strangely benefits from it in a way, because it brings him into the media and he looks like kind of a rebel to the population, that like the smears are so obvious lies that it kind of rebounds against them. Right. So there's this sort of dynamic there. And the same goes for this to a certain extent. But because, like you said, Jeremy Corbyn is, in reality, has a long history of anti-racism. You know, he's someone who's been on the left of the Labour Party for decades and took anti-racist positions for such a long time, even when it wasn't necessarily very popular in the Labour Party, when the Labour Party was more right-wing, has to be said. It goes to the core. These accusations actually do kind of hurt. So people are really sort of taken aback by it, and it does cause dissension. And people then go out of their way when there's an accusation of anti-Semitism. Some people are maybe not as familiar with the State of Israel's strategy of making these kind of false accusations, kind of go out of their way to apologize when more often than not, there's actually nothing to apologize for. You know, there has been a few isolated cases on the margins where people have said stupid things or even anti-Semitic things. I mean, but that's bad. The Labour Party, but all the evidence shows that actually the level of anti-Semitism in the Labour Party is far less than any other of the mainstream political parties in the UK. All the evidence shows that time and time again. But this is sort of consistently ignored amid all these headlines about anti-Semitism controversy in the Labour Party, anti-Semitism crisis. But when you actually look for the evidence of it, it's not there.
We're speaking with Asa Winstanley about the report authored by him from the Electronic Intifada about the fact that the assertions of anti-Semitism against Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party are partly, at least, and maybe mainly, the consequence of a concerted covert operation using fake accounts on social media. I'm looking, Asa, at the Washington Post headlines about this story from the past year. A British police launched probe into allegation of anti-Semitic speech by Labour Party members. Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party's anti-Semitic problem is in quotes, become a crisis. And then the headlines are mixed in with the synagogue shooting in Pittsburgh by the deranged anti-Semite who massacred people in a Pittsburgh synagogue. Again, this is a concerted effort. It's obviously a smear campaign. It also has some efficacy, some effectiveness. I'm just wondering, we know that the Israeli government is deeply alarmed about boycott, divest, sanctions. They're deeply alarmed about changing public opinion in the West. Should Jeremy Corbyn be someone who became prime minister of the UK? That would be profoundly alarming, I would say, to the Israeli government. Do you have any sense that Israeli intelligence was part of this operation against Corbyn?
Well, in terms of the trolls, as I've written in the article, of these particular 10 accounts, and I must say that I've no doubt that these are the tip of the iceberg. You know, I just had to stop researching at a certain point because it was incredibly time consuming. But in terms of this particular network, I can't show definitively who was behind them. You know, it would be very hard to do that unless authorities take this seriously. You know, these accounts are spewing some really disgusting anti-Semitism and actually incitement to violence and murder. So, I mean, really, Twitter should get involved. You know, some of these accounts have been banned and taken offline, but that's really not good enough because they keep popping up again, you know, in different guises. And whoever's behind them is able to do this. So without any sort of involvement, a court case or involvement by police, it's hard to really know who's actually doing this. But we do know that the Israeli government and its associated propaganda organizations around the world is involved in covert operations against Jeremy Corbyn in America, in the United States, and in many other countries. And it is targeting people who are in solidarity with Palestine. And Jeremy Corbyn has a decades-long history of involvement in the Palestine solidarity movement. So the prospect of him entering number 10 is kind of a nightmare for them. And you know, the Israeli ambassador to London, Mark Regev, a few years ago, was essentially sent to London as a new ambassador. And you can bet that one of his top priorities was to create a kind of dissension within the Labour Party and to try and stop Jeremy Corbyn becoming prime minister. And failing that, at least sort of from their point of view, moderating his policies.
That was the voice of Asa Winstanley. He is an investigative journalist with the Electronic Intifada and a columnist of Middle East Monitor, whose article, Fake Labor Accounts Fueling Anti-Semitism Crisis. Thank you, Asa Winstanley, for your journalism, for breaking this story. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Again, this week we look at the worst, the most misleading, the funniest, and just the dumbest headlines of the past week. Joining us from the San Francisco Bay Area is Steve Pat. He's an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his site, Left Eye on the News, at Left Eye, that's L-E-F-T, the letter I, .blogspot.com, where you can find all the worst headlines we don't get to. In other words, after this show is over, there's going to be more headlines we haven't discussed. Go to his blog. Steve tweets at Left Eye Blog, and we're joined in studio by Nicole Russell. She is a Sputnik News analyst and one of the producers of this show. Steve Pat, Nicole, welcome back.
Thanks, Brian.
Glad to be back.
Glad to have you. Let's start, of course, right this morning, Steve. There was a meeting in DuPont Circle between Mike Pompeo and Kim Jong-un's chief negotiator about a possible second meeting between Trump and Kim Jong-un. Again, Korea's in the news. But let's talk about this headline, because it's going in a kind of a different direction from a possible normalization of relations with North Korea.
Yeah, not to be cynical, but I personally wouldn't be surprised if there's a connection between those two events. The headline from the New York Times a couple of days ago, North Korea's less known military threat, biological weapons. Now, from that headline, you have to assume that North Korea has biological weapons. And, you know, maybe they do. I don't personally know if they do or they don't. But one thing I do know is that the New York Times does not know either. If you read this article, it's an utterly scurrilous, virtually evidence-free article, just filled with speculation. They might do this. They could have done that, et cetera, et cetera. They even admit in the course of the article, this is a direct quote, today the North might well have no bioweapons at all. But there was the headline saying this is a major military threat. It's just really a kind of disgusting stuff.
I guess that's why it's less known, because we're not even sure if it exists.
Yeah, exactly.
Whether North Korea has or does not have biological weapons, again, which you could never know from this particular headline or that particular story. I'm just looking at another headline. This is from the Insurge Intelligence website. It's something I actually know a little bit about, not much, but I've been working on it for some time, trying to tell the truth about the Korean War. The headline is, and this is from February 2018, revealed the long-suppressed official report on U.S. biowarfare in North Korea. The first lines, written largely by the most prestigious British scientists of his day, this official report containing hundreds of pages of evidence about the use of U.S. biological weapons during the Korean War was effectively suppressed upon its original release in 1952. Again, people should do their own research on this. I've done research. I've talked to some of the people who are older. They were older. I also went to North Korea and South Korea and talked to civilian victims of the Korean War. We did videotapes and eyewitness testimony. Yes, according to this report that was suppressed in the middle of the witch hunt and the Cold War, the U.S. did in fact employ biological weapons. Again, we can't categorically say it's true, but this is from esteemed scientists who went to North Korea and studied soil samples and who did a great deal of research to compile this report, again, not made really available to the public.
Well, we know the U.S. has used biological weapons and chemical weapons in a lot of places around the world, but I've never read about that in a U.S. headline. You know, growing up, you think, well, it's just other places. It's places in the Middle East, or it's, you know, other kind of U.S. enemies are the only people using biological weapons. And half the time, that's not true. But the U.S., we know for sure, maybe not in this case for sure, but we know that they use them in many other places.
Including in the original wars against indigenous communities in the United States. Let's go on to the next story, Steve.
Okay, this is a story that you've talked about, but I want to talk a little bit about the media aspect of the story, which is the headline reads, Facebook identifies Russia-linked misinformation campaign. That's from the New York Times. And it's about this Facebook banning a whole bunch of hundreds of accounts linked to Sputnik employees in Europe, I guess. And notice the word misinformation in the headline. And if you read the article, the very first sentence uses the word disinformation. And in my local paper, the Mercury News, a related story, basically the same story, even used the term fake news. But what's interesting about that is there isn't a single example in this article or the Mercury News article of any incorrect or even misleading information that was posted by any of these accounts. The only reference to any content of these articles, and I'm going to quote here from the New York Times, is some presented negative views toward NATO and the treatment of ethnic Russians in Baltic countries. Now, expressing negative views towards NATO is not a disinformation. It's an opinion. I mean, it's just crazy that they want to spread this idea that these accounts are misinforming, disinforming, or fake news, spreading this stuff. There's no evidence. Maybe they are. I haven't read any of these accounts, but there's certainly no evidence being presented that they have done so.
Also, this is an opinion, you know, could be an opinion based on the fact that NATO has surrounded Russia with, you know, NATO bases. So I could understand maybe why someone there might not have great opinions of NATO.
And the partner with Facebook to decide what's authentic or inauthentic is, of course, the Atlantic Council, the think tank located right around the corner from where we are. And the Atlantic Council, a nonprofit organization, very right-wing neocon think tank, guess what? Funded by NATO.
Exactly. The article actually quotes Ben Nimmo from the Atlantic Council saying, Facebook's decision to block Sputnik-linked accounts was significant because of the agency's direct ties to the Kremlin, but the article fails to mention the Atlantic Council's ties to NATO. I mean, it's just, you know, what can you say?
Also, many of these accounts, as we discussed yesterday on the show, were like completely unrelated to any of this, as always, right? There was a page about travel to Lithuania.
The Sputnik bureau chiefs, like in Latvia, they didn't deny it. When the Atlantic Council called them, they said, yeah, these are general, like, if you're going to Latvia and you want to learn about Latvian cuisine, so it's a general, or Latvian travel, or a Latvian...
Or like Georgian wine. Like there are, it's a marketing strategy. There are pages of...
It's promotion. So you have Sputnik employees create general interest pages. They post some of their stuff. Of course, the Sputnik Bureau from Latvia is also covering these stories. Anyway, let's keep going. Time's short. Let's go to the next one.
Let's turn to two misleading headlines, and they're both about this model whose name was Anastasia Vashukovich. The first one from CBS News. Jailed model who claimed she had dirt on Russian oligarch speaks out. What did she speak out about? She spoke out that she was glad to be released and looking forward to a free life. She didn't have anything to say about her relationship to Deripaska, the monarch in question. And then the Washington Post has a different slant on the headline. Model who claimed U.S.-Russian collusion tape held in Moscow on prostitution charges. So as far, this is just a way of putting the word collusion in the headline and keeping it in people's minds. When you get to the fourth paragraph, it says, no evidence has emerged of the tape that Vashukovich claimed showed contacts between Trump campaign officials and Russians. So these are just two stories which are designed to, you know, make people think there's smoke, or but there's not even any smoke, much less fire. But they got to keep the stuff in the headlines to keep people thinking about it.
Amazing. Let's keep going. What's the next one?
The next one, we'll call it one of our funny headlines. I thought it was funny. Kamala Harris is hard to define politically. Maybe that's the point. Really? As far as I can tell from everything I know about her, and I'm here in California, Kamala Harris is a totally typical centrist Democrat. She's, you know, not much different from almost any of the other Democrats running for office or in office. She's a slightly more likable version of Hillary Clinton. Hard to define politically? No.
Fairly easy to define politically, it turns out. We earlier in the show, in the first hour, Jackie Lukman was saying the same thing. Kamala Harris is a cop. I mean, that's what she's been, you know, she's been a prosecutor for a long time. That's her bread and butter.
Let's keep moving.
Okay, this is from the New York Times, and it bugged me. Headline, Pompeo presses Saudi leader on war, murder, and rights abuses. So who says he pressed the Saudi leader on war, murder, and rights abuses? The original article, actually, there wasn't a single word to support that use of that in the headline, which is really making Pompeo sound good, right? He was really pressing the, you know, Mohammed bin Salman on what a bad guy he is. But by the next day, they actually changed the headline to Pompeo says he pressed Saudi leader on war and rights abuses. So I thought that was rather amusing.
So the source was Pompeo. I was good. I am good.
Pompeo source, reports.
Mike Pompeo.
Excellent guy.
We have 2 minutes left, Steve. Let's keep moving. These are really, really important headlines to be exposing. Go ahead.
This one is from the Express in the UK, and it was just a really irritating headline. Iran nuclear weapons. How many nuclear weapons does Tehran have? Well, and then I'll read a quote from the start of the article. Iran considers its space program a matter of national pride, although an exact number of nuclear weapons is not known. Actually, it is known. It's a very small number. It's zero. I mean, not only don't they have nuclear weapons, they don't even have a nuclear weapons program. They haven't. There's evidence that they might have had some fragments of a nuclear weapons research, you know, two decades ago. But the idea that they are even asking the question, the fact that they put this in people's minds is what these headlines are all about. You see a headline like that, how many nuclear weapons does Tehran have? And you're thinking, you know, now it's just a given. They have weapons. The only question is how many.
But we know they've gone through the most intrusive screenings for weapons of anybody in the world.
30 seconds left, Steve. We haven't talked about Rand Paul once this week on our show.
This is an attempted gotcha, which was in widespread use in multiple media sources. Rand Paul heading to Canada, land of universal health care for surgery. So they think this is supposed to be a big gotcha because Rand Paul's an opponent of Obamacare and so on. But this whole story was totally misleading because he's going to Canada to a private hospital to pay for his own surgery. So is this not as was presented in many left liberal media?
I have to say, I didn't read the story. I just read the headline and I thought it was because
of
that.
No, I did too.
I mean, it's 100% misleading.
Yeah.
Not that we're friends of Rand Paul, and certainly we're friends of universal health care, but again, that's disgusting. Anyway, we're out of time. We were joined from San Francisco by Steve Pat. Steve is an independent journalist. His critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his site, Left Eye on the News, at lefti.blogspot.com, where you can find all of the worst headlines we didn't get to. We got to a lot this week, but there are some more. Steve tweets at Left Eye Blog, and we were joined in studio by Nicole Roussel. She is a Sputnik news analyst and one of the producers of this show. We will be back Tuesday, not Monday, because it's the Martin Luther King federal holiday. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and you want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and clear.